It's time for Midday Edition on KPBS. For today's show, a new book on how to live gently, plus midday movies and your weekend preview. I'm Jade Hindman, with conversations that keep you informed, inspired, and engaged. If this sounds like you,
not saving rest and taking care until I am sick and worn out and exhausted.
You'll want to hear what Courtney Carver's new book on rest and simplifying your life is about. Then our movie critics honor Black History Month with recommendations on films and a book on birding in your weekend preview. So are you feeling overwhelmed, tired, stressed? If so, you're not alone. A lot of people are feeling that way these days, and we're often pushing ourselves to do more, faster, without pausing to rest. But we can't be our best selves without recharging our batteries. And my next guest has a new book out all about doing just that. It's called Gentle: Rest More, Stress Less, and Live the Life You Actually Want. Her name is Courtney Carver, and she'll be bringing her book, Gentle, to Warwick's Bookstore in La Jolla on Monday. Courtney joins me now. Welcome to Midday Edition.
Thank you.
So you've been on our show to talk about your last two books, actually, Project 333, about paring down our closets, and Soulful Simplicity, about living with less. How does this new book, Gentle, build on those first two?
Gentle is really a natural progression and something that I've noticed in my simplicity journey that has happened over time, in that now that I've created space by decluttering and living with less, I have time to see what I really want and need in my life. And one thing, for instance, that I was often avoiding was rest, because that just seemed to show up at the end of my to-do list, if it ever even made the list. And Gentle is just a bigger picture of how to take care of ourselves in a way that's, I think, different from a lot of self-help and self-care recommendations.
Well, then let's get into that. I mean, what does living gently mean to you?
To me, living gently means not pushing through at all costs, not giving my all, and not saving rest and taking care until I am sick and worn out and exhausted, but instead prioritizing it so I might avoid being sick, tired, and exhausted.
Well, tell me about that. Tell me about your own story. Is chronic overwhelm something you've had to cope with in your own life?
Definitely. I think most of us do. I mean, from what we put on our own schedules and what's involved in just being a human adult, and then everything that's going on around us, I think we all go through phases of overwhelm. And for me, it all kind of came to a screeching halt in 2006 when I was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. It was such a big wake-up call for me to be able to say, I have to take care of myself now. I'm giving myself permission to take care, because I can't ignore how I feel and how my health is. It has to come first. And that really opened the door not only for healing around MS, but in every other area of my life, learning how to ask myself, what is important to me? How do I feel? What do I need? And then trusting myself and trusting the answers and acting accordingly.
It's great that you've really come to that place in your life. In this book, you really examine the relationship between rest and guilt. Break that down for me.
Yes, I think it is time for us to redefine guilt, because we use that word quite frequently, especially when it comes to resting, doing nothing, not finishing what's on our to-do list. We feel guilty, or we say we feel guilty because we didn't do it all, or we feel guilty because we took a nap in the afternoon and we weren't being productive. And I think that what's really happening is that it's making us feel uncomfortable. So instead of guilt, which really indicates that you've done something wrong, we feel uncomfortable because we're doing the things we need to do to take care of ourselves, and we're not used to doing that. And so it feels like we're not measuring up. We're not doing what other people expect us to do. We're not doing what we thought we were supposed to do as a thriving adult. But actually, rest and taking care is far more productive than doing things you don't care about. And again, really pushing through to get to the next level or the next place or the next thing.
Mm-hmm. So where does this feeling of guilt and discomfort come from as it relates to rest? What's the root of that?
I really think it comes from both current day hustle culture and also the messages that we've all received as we are growing up, which is work hard, do your best, give your all, and anything short of that, you're falling short. So we internalize those messages, and when it's time to do nothing, we stress about everything we have to get done because we think that's what we're supposed to be doing. So I think it really is sometimes almost an underlying sense of, is this okay? Is it okay to do absolutely nothing in the middle of the day on a Saturday? Or am I supposed to be getting more things done just for the sake of getting things done? And when we really start to vocalize that, I think we can see that it's not about what we want. It's not about how we want to live our life. It's about what's expected of us or what we think is expected of us, which isn't always the case.
Mm. One chapter of your book is called Breaking Up with Breaking News. So, Courtney, I mean, tell me what this chapter is all about.
It's about thinking about how we take in news. And right now, and for many years, really, it seems like all news is breaking and that breaking news is broken. It's all about the splashy headline, what's going to pull us in, what's going to scare us into reading more. And people are really distraught about the news currently. And also, they don't know how to stop because it's so easy to start doom scrolling or to get sucked in by one article and then start scrolling on Instagram and finding all of these things that kind of go along with it. And it can be, instead of, you know, a 2 or 3 minute story that you hear about the news, half of your day is consumed by fear and anxiety to the point where it's not helping us. It's not helping us contribute or take action in any meaningful way. And so within the chapter, I recommend setting boundaries around your news consumption. For instance, I try not to take in any news in the morning or in the evening near bedtime. I don't think there's anything that's going on that is worth wasting a night of sleep over when I know I'll be much more effective the next day if I have slept well. And then also consider how you want to take the news in. Do you want to read it? Do you want to listen to it? Do you want to watch it? And where? We have to be more intentional about how we take the news in because it is just like a fire hose.
Right. I mean, there's so much to be taken in. What are your thoughts on the timing of when this book is coming out and all of the changes we're seeing come out of the Trump administration?
I think that it makes it more necessary than ever for this book to be available, because what's happening, the messaging that we're getting is everything's chaotic. We need to be confused. We need to be overwhelmed. And everything is really doom and gloom. And I'm not saying there isn't a lot to be outraged about, because there is. But if we want a chance at being healthy and helping where we can help, supporting organizations that we want to support, taking part in our local communities, you know, all of these things that are going to make a difference, we have to take care of ourselves. And so while everyone is yelling at us to be in chaos, this book, Gentle, is saying it's okay if you want to do it a different way and have a like I said, just a fighting chance of feeling okay through this, even though there's plenty not to feel okay about.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, some people will hear you need to rest and feel like it's dismissive of their real life responsibilities. What are your thoughts on how privilege influences who can and can't rest and engage in self-care?
Such an important question and something I've been thinking about a lot, especially just recently. You know, how can I protect my peace without shrinking into my privilege? Because I can do that in a million different ways. And so, yes, it would be lovely if self-care and being gentle were accessible to everyone. And I'd love to see more ways for that to happen. And I think there are also stages of life, no matter where you are, that are going, it's going to be more challenging because of your lifestyle, because of the stage of life you are in. So I think it's an ongoing conversation that we need to be able to help each other in terms of, you know, those of us who can take care of ourselves, how can we weave in community care so that more people have this as an option?
And simplifying your life, remind us what your book about living with simplicity was about. What are some ways that we can simplify our lives?
Yeah, there's actually a section in Gentle. So there's three sections in the book, Rest, Less, and Rise. And the entire section about less really is about that simplicity element. So removing excess things in your life that are causing stress, the things that are within your control, and I know not everything is, but the clutter around you. Do you need everything that's in your house? Are you enjoying it? Are you spending more time taking care of it and thinking about it and dealing with it, cleaning it, organizing it, than it's worth? Clutter. So in your home, clutter on your calendar. What about the things that you're filling your days with? I know we're all very busy and we have things to do. Do we have to do it all? Does it all need to be nonstop, back-to-back appointments, meetings, obligations, or can we release some of that? Same for our to-do lists. Really thinking about where the stress in your life is coming from and considering if things might be better without it.
Well, you know, how do you suggest people work on bringing more rest and less stress into their lives? I mean, it's not something you can immediately change all at once, right?
Of course not. However, I definitely recommend resting first when possible, because this is the thing that we resist the most. In fact, I wasn't even going to make it the first section of the book. I was thinking about saving it for the end, and I realized that it was that resistance to resting that was making me do that. And so I put it first. And so when people ask me, kind of what you just asked me about getting started on literally anything, I almost always suggest rest first, because by the time we're ready to make a change, we're usually pretty overwhelmed or tired of the way that we are living and what's going on. And our bodies and brains need that rest before we can make really thoughtful decisions moving forward.
I have been speaking with Courtney Carver. Her new book is called Gentle, Rest More, Stress Less, and Live the Life You Actually Want. Courtney, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
She'll be discussing and signing the book at Warwick's Bookstore on Monday. More information on the event can be found at kpbs.org. Our midday movie critics discuss Black women in film, both on the screen and behind the camera, like director Cheryl Dunier, who made this next movie, The Watermelon Woman.
Hi, I'm Cheryl, and I'm a filmmaker. I'm not really a filmmaker, but I have a videotaping business with my friend Tamara, and I work at a video store, so I'm working on being a filmmaker. The problem is I don't know what I want to make a film on.
Hear more when KPBS Midday Edition returns. Your support makes KPBS Midday Edition possible, and we're grateful to have you in our community. Now share the love. Introduce KPBS to your friends and family, and they'll receive 1 month free of KPBS Passport. This limited time offer runs through February 28, 2025. Visit kpbs.org/friends today to keep the stories that matter coming. You're listening to KPBS Midday Edition. I'm Jade Hindman. To close out Black History Month, our midday movie critics wanted to create a suggested viewing list to celebrate Black women on screen and behind the camera, and to remind people that celebrating Black film does not have to end on February 28th. Once again, I'd like to welcome back KPBS cinema junkie Beth Accomando and Movie Wallace's podcaster Yazdi Fatavala. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, to start this list, you both wanted to highlight an actress. And Beth, do you want to reveal who this actress is?
Yes. And I think what I'd like to do, like instead of a drum roll to announce her, I want to just play this trailer as an intro.
When Foxy Brown comes to town, all the brothers gather round, because she can really shake them down. Pam Grier, that one chick hit squad who creamed you as coffee, is back to do a job on the mob. As Foxy Brown.
You tell me who you want done, and I'll do the hell out of it.
A chick with drive, who don't take no jive.
That woman, she's crazy. No telling what she'll do.
And there is no telling what Pam Grier will do. I will say, Pam Grier is not only a fine actress, who's proven that in a number of films, but she is also a pop culture icon, and that has so much power to it. I mean, Cicely Tyson and Ruby Dee might have more awards, but you are not seeing their faces on T-shirts today. They are not having retrospectives of their films. But Pam Grier is someone who is still celebrated on the screen. People still will come out to her movies. I got to see her in person up in Portland. And when I saw her in Portland, she talked about getting her first job, which was with Roger Corman. And they sent her off to the Philippines for a shoot. And the plane was driving over, and they said, I'm going to slow down for you to jump out. And she said, what are you talking about? And he says, no, I'm serious. And he said, I'm sorry, you missed your chance. I'm going to circle back around. Either you jump out with your bag, or you have to take a two-hour bus to get to the location. So he slowed down, and she jumped out, and she started a career in movies and eventually, you know, made it into a lot of very well-known Blaxploitation films like Coffee, Foxy Brown, Friday Foster. I was a young girl in the 70s, and her image was really impactful to me. And I loved being able to see someone who had this kind of, like, power and force. One of her best films was Foxy Brown. And in this scene, she approaches a group which is fashioned after, like, the Black Panther Party. And she basically wants them to help her fight drugs and corruption coming from this white mob.
What is it you really want?
Justice.
For whom? Your brother?
Why not? It could be your brother, too. Or your sister. Or your children. I want justice for all of them. And I want justice for all the other people whose lives are bought and sold so that a few big shots can climb up on their backs and laugh at the law and laugh at human decency. And most of all, I want justice for a good man. And he died. Because he went out of his neighborhood to try to do what he thought was right.
Sister, I think what you're asking for is revenge.
You just take care of the justice, and I'll handle the revenge myself.
Well, you just preach it, Pam. Okay. Yazdi, you are also a fan of Grier. What is it that you like about her?
Yeah, two things. One is that her sexuality was a big part of her power in all of her films. And she kind of rode that proudly through the 70s and 80s female liberation movement. So she never tried to kind of disown it or disassociate it. She kind of embraced it, as Beth mentioned earlier. And Quentin Tarantino rightly called her the first female action star of American cinema, which is not bad for someone who started as a receptionist in Los Angeles. Along those lines, the second point is that she has survived over decades. I mean, here we are in 2025, and we are still speaking about her. Even after her heydays with the blaxploitation films, she was a regular on Miami Vice on television. She was in action films with Steven Seagal in the late 1980s. And Tarantino, after having come off this huge high following the success of Pulp Fiction, gave her the lead role in his next film, which was Jackie Brown. And to give you an example, here is a really crackling scene of Jackie Brown asserting herself during an interrogation in the film Jackie Brown.
What in the bag she gave you?
She didn't give me a bag. Melanie was not a part of the plan. Ordell probably told her to do it. That's why she came into the dressing room, grabbed the bag, took off, but I couldn't go after her because I was f***ing underwear. And I had to put on this suit because I could put it on faster than my uniform.
You had time to pay the sales check?
I had to. Ray, I was frantic. What was I supposed to do?
All right, what'd you do after that?
I went looking for you. And I went back to the place in the mall where you were before, but you weren't there. What was I supposed to do if something happens? You didn't tell me how to do that, did you?
There's a guy with Melanie?
There was nobody in the fitting room.
You've no idea about the $50,000. You're clueless about the money, right? You have no idea what the 50 grand is.
I have no idea.
None.
None.
You have no idea? You
no.
don't know? It could have gone here, could have
no,
gone there.
I don't
you
know.
Don't
know. I know nothing.
Clueless.
Not a clue.
Not
I don't
idea.
Have an idea no. where...
For radio, we'll have to cut the clip off right there. There are a lot of other Black actresses that deserve shout-outs in addition to Greer, but we're going to move on to highlight some Black women behind the camera. Beth, who do you want to highlight and spotlight today?
Because people seem to have a short-term memory, I always like to go back a little further in the past to kind of remind people of some groundbreaking work that's been done that maybe isn't as well known these days. So I want to highlight Julie Dash, who directed the 1991 film Daughters of the Dust. This is noteworthy as being the first full-length feature film directed by an African-American woman that got a general theatrical release in the U.S. It's a gorgeous film, and it recently got a new 4K restoration. So this film is set in 1902. It's kind of a poetic, nonlinear film. It serves up a fictionalized account of a Gula family who lives off the coast of southeastern United States. And in this scene, there's a character who recounts a tale of slave resistance from 1803.
The slavery time, the war my gran always talk about, those Igbo didn't miss a thing. When they got through sizing up the place real good and seeing what was to come, my gran said it turned. All of them. And walk back in the water. Every last man, woman, and child. Now you wouldn't think they'd get bare fast seeing as it was water they was walk on. Had all that iron upon them. Upon their ankle and their wrist. And fastened round their neck like dog collar. But chain didn't stop those Igbo none. They just kept walk like the water was solid ground.
So Julie Dash hasn't made a lot of feature films recently. She had announced doing a biopic of Angela Davis, which I hope happens. But most of her work these days has been directing television.
Wow, and that would be great. And Yazdi, which director would you like to highlight?
So I want to highlight Casey Lemons, whose most celebrated work is the movie Eve's Bayou. Casey Lemons started as a very hardworking actress through most of the 80s and early 90s. And incidentally, she was in the original 1992 Candyman film as an actress. And Eve's Bayou is this gorgeous Southern Gothic melodrama with Lynn Whitfield and Samuel L. Jackson. It's a gorgeous, beautiful film with so much surrealism and mysteries. And it's just a very complete piece of work. She followed up with the movie Caveman's Valentine, also with Samuel L. Jackson. And then her other film, which is also very well regarded, is Talk to Me with Don Cheadle, playing Ralph Peedy Green, who was an incarcerated man who became a talk show host and then a major political activist in the 60s. So By way of an introduction to Eve's Bayou, here's a clip from the movie with Samuel L. Jackson and Journey Smollett playing father and daughter.
You love mama?
Your mama is the most beautiful, perfect woman I ever met. Your mama's a lady, and I'll always love her. Always. Understand?
Daddy?
Yes, baby.
How come you never dance with me?
Baby, how can you say your daddy never dances with you?
When we're alone and stuff, but not at parties, you always dance with Cicely.
Tell you what, from now on, we'll dance at every party, right?
Wow, a very young Journey Smollett
yes,
there.
Yes.
And Yazdi, the other movie that you mentioned too, Talk to Me, the story of Petey Green, one of my favorites. The best line in that movie was, "He's a corner pimp who I wouldn't trust to wash my car, but y'all done elected him." Wow, does that apply to so many things? Okay. Bev, your next director pick also made her debut in the 1990s, along with Julie Dash and Casey Lemon. Who is she?
So this is Cheryl Dunier, and she was part of the queer new wave of the 1990s. So she kind of was jumping multiple hurdles as a female filmmaker, a black filmmaker, and a queer filmmaker. And Watermelon Woman was her feature film debut, and it's still my favorite of hers. It's the most innovative and most interesting. Like Julie Dash, she mostly directs TV nowadays, but Watermelon Woman was this kind of self-reflexive film examining not just herself as an artist, but also the medium of film itself and also representation. So this is a clip from the film in which Dunier plays a young woman who is about to make a film, a documentary about an actress she has discovered.
Hi, I'm Cheryl, and I'm a filmmaker. I'm not really a filmmaker, but I have a videotaping business with my friend Tamara, and I work at a video store, so I'm working on being a filmmaker. The problem is I don't know what I want to make a film on. I know it has to be about black women because our stories have never been told, so I've been renting movies. No, I haven't been renting movies, but I get movies from the video store that I work at, and I've taken all these films out from the 30s and 40s with black actresses in them, like Hattie McDaniel and Louise Beavers. And in these films, in some of the films, the black actresses aren't even listed in the credits. And I was just totally shocked by that. So in this one film that came into the store, Plantation Memories, I saw the most beautiful black mammy named Elsie. Her name, the Watermelon Woman. That's right, Watermelon Woman. Is Watermelon Woman her first name, her last name, or is it her whole name? I don't know, but girlfriend has it going on, and I think I've figured out what my project's going to be on. I'm going to make a movie about her.
All right. And Yazdi, you have a director who made her feature debut in 2000. Who is that?
That would be Gina Prince-Blythewood, who made her directorial debut with the wonderful movie Love and Basketball. What I like about her is her versatility. She obviously started with making this wonderfully grounded rom-com by way of Love and Basketball. And again, if nobody's seen it, what a wonderful film to discover. But at the same time, she's also made more edgy movies like Beyond the Lights, which is a wonderful contemporary exploration of race and celebrity, something that a lot of filmmakers have not assessed. And then most recently, Gina Prince-Blythewood has been very successful by taking on full-bodied, full-blooded action films for Hollywood. She made the excellent action thriller The Old Guard with Charlize Theron, and then most recently the Viola Davis starring The Woman King in 2022. And here's a clip from the trailer for The Woman King.
An evil is coming that threatens our kingdom, our freedom. But we have a weapon. They are not prepared for.
My king, the Europeans wish to conquer us. They will not stop until the whole of Africa is theirs. We must fight back for our people.
Aniska, you are asking me to take them to war.
All of these sound fantastic. I want to thank our midday movie critics, KPBS Cinema Junkie Beth Accomando and Movie Wallace's podcaster Yazzie Pathavala. You can watch our midday movies podcast now on the KPBS YouTube channel to see clips from all the films. Beth and Yazzie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jade.
And we will go out with Pam Grier singing Longtime Woman from The Big Doll House, which Quentin Tarantino then used in Jackie Brown.
I'm a longtime woman, and I'm serving my time. I've been locked away so long now, I've forgotten my
Coming up, Joy Luck Club author Amy Tan talks about her love for birding and her most recent book, The Backyard Bird Chronicles, ahead of the San Diego Bird Festival.
I had the opportunity to do birding in my life. We all have, because the birds are all around us.
Hear more in your weekend preview when KPBS Midday Edition returns.
From news to culture, KPBS podcasts keep you informed and inspired. Now, share the love. Invite your friends and family to KPBS, and they'll receive 1 month free of KPBS Passport. Act now. This offer is available through February 28, 2025. Visit kpbs.org/friends today.
You're listening to KPBS Midday Edition. I'm Jade Hindman. Author Amy Tan published The Joy Luck Club in 1989 and has put out nearly a dozen other books since, including novels, children's books, and nonfiction. In her latest work, The Backyard Bird Chronicles, she documents a period of 5 years through observations about the birds in her backyard and her growing obsession with birding. This Saturday, she'll be speaking at the San Diego Bird Festival, which celebrates birds of all kinds in our region. Festival organizers say it's one of the birdiest regions in the United States. KPBS arts reporter Julia Dixon Evans recently had a chance to interrupt Tan's bird watching to discuss the book and her love for birding. Here's that conversation.
So this book, it's a collection of journal entries and sketches taken from like a regular bird observation diary that you kept in this book in particular. It's a 5-year period from 2017 through the end of 2022. Can we start by talking about how much writing you had to weed through to come up with that? Like, was there an entry for nearly every day?
No, there wasn't an entry for every day, but sometimes there would be days where there would be 10 entries. Mm. So there was no set rule about how I kept this thing. I also kept some pages loosely, whatever I could find around the house at the time when I saw something really exciting. But largely, they were kept in a journal that was a leather-bound, very special journal where I would keep, you know, other kind of journal notes. And I eventually dedicated the journals just to the bird entries. And at the time, I also thought that I would be looking at all of my backyard. So it was called the Backyard Chronicles and not the Backyard Bird Chronicles. But shortly after, it became all birds. So I have about probably 15 journals that have bird entries in them. But I only used a few, I think about 150 of the drawings and entries from all the journals. So I did pick and choose those, but more on the basis of a variety of birds and behaviors than anything.
I want to ask you about something you just said about the evolution of your journal being a regular journal to becoming only birds. Like, is that kind of a metaphor for what happened to you as an individual?
Right. The evolution of the person. What happened to the novel, you should ask. Because I think of my life and everything that I write, whether it's a scrap of paper with my daily notes of what I need to do for the, you know, get accomplished, or a grocery list, or a packing list, or notes on mortality, that it's all part of the same thing. And it goes into the evolution of who I am. And it's just that the birds became a more all-consuming activity for me, especially during that time when we were not really doing much of anything. We were not supposed to go outdoors even. And so I had, much to my delight, guilty delight, permission to simply sit there and watch these birds. And that's all I had to do. So yeah, it definitely part of the evolution of me. And it's reflected in now what has become a book. That book had to be pried out of me, by the way, from my editor, because I suffer from what's known as perfection syndrome. A lot of people have that. You don't want to show off, you know, anything that looks half done or that has bad mistakes in there, especially if you're a writer. And when he suggested we publish it, I said, it's a mess. Hmm. And he said, well, that's authentic. That's what we want. And I thought, what a great word. You know, if you have anything that's imperfect, if you look terrible in the morning, you know, look at yourself in the mirror and just say, hey, I'm authentic today.
I love that. I feel like this is a great time to ask you about this, the drawings and the sketches of birds, because in your 2017 memoir, you had talked about how you were a beginner at drawing birds, drawing in general, and you were self-conscious about your skills. But now in this book, the sketches play such a big part, not just to the book, but to your relationship with birding. Can you talk about what attracted you to the act of drawing?
Well, I loved drawing when I was a little kid. In fact, I found something that I actually refer to in that memoir, Where the Past Begins, that I had found something, that an interview that my father had done with an educator. And I had been part of a longitudinal study on early reading. And he said these words I'd never heard him say before, that I had an amazing imagination. And that even before the age of four, I was drawing pictures and telling stories about them. And it could have been the other way around, where I had the stories and then I just illustrated them. But what it indicates to me is that this quality of imagination that's both visuals and storytelling came about at an early age, and it continued throughout my life.
Becoming attached to birds has introduced new forms of vulnerability and tragedy in your life with these birds, losing birds and seeing diseases or injuries on them. But in one entry in particular, you're able to use the birds to give language to grief when you lost a close friend. I'm wondering how birding has supported you through periods of grief or difficult times.
You know, I was thinking the other day, you know, things are uncertain as funding of different things, bird, you know, fish and wildlife. We're losing some programs. And I was recalling how anxiety and the feelings we have, despair, anxiety, hopelessness, they have to do with what happens when we wait. When we wait and we feel that only bad things are going to come, that lends itself to further depression, despair, and hopelessness. But if we wait for birds to come, if I sit there and wait and I wait for the bird to land on the fence, they climb up over onto the fence, and then they come down into the yard. Every time I do that, I will see something so wonderful and so beautiful that it instantly gives me the kind of feeling I need to have to hope for something better for the future. It's the practice of hope, which is waiting for something good. Mm. And that is part of, you know, the gift of bird watching, what that has been for me. Because it immediately sends me to a different place where I cannot be thinking about worries and what might be lost. So if it's with a friend, I can see life, I can see the humor, I can identify with a certain bird that has chosen to arrive by coincidence or maybe not coincidence. And it reminds me of this person who just died. And I want to say to myself, is it in fact Asa? Is this in fact Tom? And I will see more. Now, this may be the quality of coincidence intersecting with grief. coming up with an imagination of what you would like to have be the case. But I say to myself, whether it's real enough, it's needed, and I'll take it.
You've talked about imagination and birding. If you could reflect on the release of some of your earlier books, like Dry Look Club, like, do you ever think about how different your writing life or your creativity or even your approach to story and characters, how different that might be if you had birding in your life?
You know, I had the opportunity to do birding in my life. We all have, because the birds are all around us. I loved nature when I was a child. I would go down to the creek. My parents ever took us to the lake, I would catch snakes and frogs and lizards. I was a nature girl. Didn't get enough of it. But I think there are parts of our lives that come to us at different moments that we never would have appreciated when we were younger. And I think the birds came into my life at the right time. I was ready for it. I was so hungry for it. I look at everything in my life and say, now, if this hadn't happened, would I have even become a writer? There were times when I was younger where I would have wished I didn't have this life. I wished I wasn't Chinese. I wished that I had blonde hair and big tits, you know. I wished that my mother wasn't my mother. You know, all of these things that we might have wished for when at different points of our lives, but that leads up to all the things that made me who I am. And so I don't regret any of it. I wouldn't want to alter any of it. I wouldn't want to say I want to be a birder sooner in life, because that's going to change me in another way. It'll help me grieve for my father and my brother who died when I was 15. It will help me deal with my mother better so that I won't have these certain, you know, notions of what a mother and a daughter are to one another. I need to go through that difficulty. And the things that I wrote about never would have come about if I had been a happier, a sadder person, a more nature-enriched person. It all leads to the evolution of who I was at that moment and when I wrote those things.
That was author Amy Tan speaking with KPBS arts reporter Julia Dixon-Evans, who joins me now. Julia, welcome.
Hey, Jade. Thanks for having me.
So Amy Tan is speaking at the San Diego Bird Festival, which is currently underway through Sunday. Amy's event is sold out, but there's plenty more to explore in the festival. Tell us some more about the activities.
So, yeah, in addition to Amy Tan's talk, there are a couple of other featured speakers, including scientist Juliana Soto Patino, who she will speak about her community science research. She is like a young ornithologist, and she's going to do a presentation at the San Diego Natural History Museum Friday night at 7. That event costs $25. There's also a kayak trip where a group will go out on kayaks and paddle in the South Bay near the wetlands there, and you can look for shorebirds and all sorts of good stuff. That's Friday morning. But they also have a lot of free activities. There's drop-in art activities every day. This is all at the Marina Village Conference Center in Mission Bay. And on Saturday, they're having bird art basics lessons, so you too can be like Amy Tan and learn to draw your birds. There's nature journaling discussions, backyard birding, as well as a birding walk at the low tide. You can go around the estuary. That's at 3:30 on Saturday. And then on Sunday at noon, there's a bird photography class for young people. It's a workshop for teenagers aged 13 to 17. That should be really cool if you have young people in your life. And you can find all the events at their website at San Diego Bird Festival, or you can find some of my highlights on our website.
All right. As if that weren't enough to do in and of itself, there's still more to check out this weekend.
Yeah, so we have time for just a couple more here, so I'll do some free ones, my favorites. At Liberty Station, there's a free visual art exhibit at Gallery 201. It's already on view, and it features the Arts District Liberty Station's emerging artists in residence. Right now, that's Sean Sarmiento and Gracie Moon, and their exhibit is called All the Places We Belong. Sarmiento is this collage artist who also works with sculptural elements like Polaroids or scraps of leather, and then puts text on these collages too. And I really love how minimalist these collages are. And then sculptor Gracie Moon has created these like suspended chains that almost look like giant beaded necklaces, but the beads are jello molds that are filled with Japanese snack wrappers set in resin. And this gallery is especially cool because it's open every day from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. and it's free.
Awesome. And I also heard about the San Diego Symphony Picnic in the Park happening this weekend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the symphony started doing this about 5 years ago. It's a way of previewing their summer season at the Rady Shell. And they have performances beginning at 11:30 on Sunday. There's going to be a brass quintet from San Diego Symphony musicians. And then local pop stars Cassie B and The Farmers, both of whom are nominated for San Diego Music Awards this year. They'll also do a little performance. They'll have food for sale from all the restaurants at the Shell, but you can also bring your own picnic in. And you should definitely bring your own chairs and blankets.
You can find details on these and sign up for Julia's weekly arts newsletter on our website, kpbs.org. I've been speaking with KPBS arts reporter Julia Dixon Evans. Julia, thank you.
Thank you, Jade.
That's our show for today. I'm your host, Jade Hindman. Thanks for tuning in to Midday Edition. Be sure to have a great day on purpose, everyone.